Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, I'm Matt Kelly.
And I'm Matt D'Ancona.
And this is The Two Matts for the week ending Friday, the 22nd of December.
Dead festive.
The Chateau du Hope.
Chateau du Hope. And we boy, have we got hope for you.
We have. What did we talk about this
Well,
week?
The main subject of the week, I think, is the New Europeans' lawsuit against Michel Moon. And I think it's a really important, we discussed it in detail, and I think it's an important moment for the newspaper.
Yeah,
in 7-year history, and it's a very important cause, both journalistically, but also it speaks to a broader political problem, which you get into.
I think that's absolutely right, and it's something that I feel very passionately about.
Yeah,
I know you
too.
Do too.
Absolutely.
So, what should we call it? Should we call
Michel Moon versus the New European?
Michel Moon versus the New European is as good as anything. And we also have a special guest in part two.
That's right.
Talking about the issue of the year, I think, migration.
The excellent Zoe Gardner.
Yeah, Zoe Gardner.
She's an independent expert on migration policy, and another person who personifies the spirit of hope and practical optimism.
Yeah. She was brilliant. Well worth
really
sticking
good,
around.
Really
for.
Good.
All right. So this is Episode 27 of The Two Matts, Michel Moon versus the New European.
Enjoy.
Enjoy. So, Matt, what are we going to talk about?
Well, I think given your performance on the Today programme this morning, about the Michel Moon case, I think we have to talk about that.
Yeah.
And so maybe we could kick off with a clip from Laura Kunzberg's show on Sunday.
Definitely.
Of Michel Moon talking about what she thinks about the whole scandal, and then we can get into the detail.
Good, good.
So here we go.
I wasn't trying to pull the wool over anyone's eyes. And I regret and I'm sorry for not saying straight out, yes, I am involved. My family have gone through hell with the media over, you know, my career. And I didn't want another big hoo-ha in the press and my family to be involved in it.
The two contracts in total came to a value of £202 million. And, you know, MedPro made a return on its investment of about... realistically, about 30%.
So, about £60 million or...
Yeah,
that was Doug Barrowman, Michel Moon's husband, who led the consortium for PPE MedPro and then
MedPro.
Spent years denying any involvement whatsoever with the company. Even there, the level of evasion is apparent. You notice when he says £200 million revenue and 30%. So I'm not going to volunteer, he's saying. I'm not going to volunteer the actual number. Laura Kunzberg had to volunteer that.
Yes.
60 million quid profit. A 30% margin on that kind of scale.
122 million's worth of which was unusable.
Yeah, yeah. It's extraordinary. So they're arguing the toss about why it's unusable. But regardless of that, just the fact that they didn't even have a company until when COVID happened. They heard that COVID was happening. They scrambled together a consortium, went to the Far East. And I am told reliably that buying PPE was not a challenge. It was just a question of who could get there first. And they got there early, you know.
And of what quality they were. So let's start at the sort of end of the story with why the New European is suing Michel Moon. Because I think it's important for our listeners to understand why the newspaper is doing this and what it means.
So here's the sequence of events in short order. And firstly, I want to give credit to David Conn at The Guardian, because the truth is that David Conn for years has led this investigation and has diligently
Back to 2020.
And David is one of the great investigative journalists of our time, and did amazing work over Hillsborough, which I followed my entire career, and picked up on this scandal. And David and his team at The Guardian had been threatened with lawsuits by Michelle Moan's lawyers for ever since they were doing it. Now, we came into it a little later into the narrative, and we ran a front page of Michelle Moan. It's quite a famous photograph now of her stood on the deck of this yacht called
the Lady M.
A yacht which she had a photograph of on her Instagram account with the caption, "Business isn't easy, but it's rewarding," right? So here's a photograph of her stood on this yacht, and we put it under the headline, "Stop this boat," you know? And
this was in August, wasn't it?
In August this year. "Stop this boat," because this boat is illustrative of the kind of cronyism and corruption that this government has become absolutely, you know, famous world famous for. The day after, we get a legal threat from Michelle Moan saying she's going to sue us for defamation unless we withdraw the article, withdraw all copies of the newspaper from sale, apologise publicly, and pay damages to a charity of her choice. Now, our reality as a small independent publisher is that we don't have in-house lawyers. So anytime somebody does this, and they do it from time to time, we have to employ a media lawyer, which inevitably ends up costing us several thousand quid. And
At least.
And, you know, inevitably, we've never been successfully sued because we are very diligent about staying on the right side of the line of what one can say.
Yeah.
You know, and the law is there to protect fair reporting and honest and fair comment on facts. So we told Michelle Moan to F off, effectively. But we also said to her, since you are relying on your insistence that you have no ownership in this boat whatsoever, then we're entitled to see documentation to that evidence. Nothing was forthcoming for weeks. We harried her. Eventually, she sent us a letter from via a solicitor who, or an ex-solicitor, I should say. He was struck off in 2011 for nefarious activities, which it's a long time ago, and I'll leave him alone on that one. But this guy was representing Moan and Barryman in this instance, sent us a letter from LM Yachts Limited, an Isle of Man registered company, which claimed to have 100% ownership of the Lady M yacht. And the letter contained the following sentence, which is that Baroness Moan has no proprietary interest, directly or indirectly, in the yacht or the company.
The right? Indirectly is very important.
Absolute bollocks.
Yeah.
Malud. Absolute bollocks.
This is a technical legal term for any people who are listening.
And I just got incredibly irritated at first, and then anger started creeping into the equation. And I thought the shamelessness of the way these people act and the sense of impunity that they have.
And entitlement.
Entitlement. And of course, the truth is that the reason they act with such impunity around their deceit and corruption is that's the waters they swim in this Tory government. You know, this, you can trace it all back to the PPE MedPro contract and the way that they've been dealing with that. So I got angry about it, and I said when Laura Koonsberg did her brilliant interview, which I think hasn't had enough credit for, really.
No, it was an excellent interview.
Because what's worth remembering is that there was a swamp of people on Twitter saying, why are the BBC giving these people a PR platform to parade their innocence and all of this? Laura was a lot better than people gave her credit for, and she gave them the room, and she asked the
rope. She gave them the rope.
She gave them the room to absolutely hang themselves with the rope, as you say. I spoke to a few people, and I said, you know what? There should be something where we can go and claim our money back. Maybe it's just in the small claims court or something like this, but we should say they've lied to us. We've acted on that deceit. It's cost us money. They knew they were being deceitful. There should be a way to sue them. And it turns out there is. It's just that it's never been done before, and it's under the tort of deceit, which is normally applied in contract law. So if I employed you and you lied to me and said, you know, you needed to borrow money and I lend you money, but it turns out you're bankrupt and you lied about that. Then I can sue you. All right. So there's nothing in theory to stop us suing Michelle Moan to recover the costs, the several thousand pounds we've laid out. The Good Law Project came in and said, we hear that you're interested in seeing if we can set some sort of a precedent here. And we thought, yeah. So we've instructed solicitors. We've got a barrister is on the case and is of the opinion that we have a strong case. We've subsequently, since I went on the radio this morning on
the Today program.
Radio to, for Today program, we've had a number of inbound offers of help pro bono. So, you know, there's a great amount of goodwill, I think, from decent people saying this is wrong and it would be great if you could do something about it to set a deterrent, you know, just so that people think twice about this. Isn't a slap case, right? Which is which slap cases are on a slightly different order of magnitude. But in some ways, what's happening here?
Can you explain?
A slap is what is selective legal action to prevent public participation or something like this, where very wealthy people, typically a Russian oligarch, will set out a load of actual legal cases to try and stymie honest reporting and tie up newspapers and news organizations in the courts. And they happen the world over, and the government is considering legislation to stop it. But in a way, this is more invidious, this, because what they're doing, what Michelle Moan has got into the habit of doing to an absurd degree, is just spewing out legal letters anytime she reads something she doesn't like, saying, this is a pre-action letter for defamation, do this, di-da-di-da-di-da, right? The most absurd one she did was to the national newspaper in Scotland, who had reported that she went on telly and said that she had a flat in Glasgow, I think, somewhere, Glasgow or Edinburgh, and that a previous occupant of this flat had been Albert Einstein. Right. No, absolute nonsense. Albert Einstein never lived in Scotland.
No, he wasn't a Goebbels boy.
The National reported the nonsense of this story. She threatens to sue them for defamation.
So this is her MO. When she has a story she doesn't like, she essentially threatens people with a financial penalty that they will they will rack up. The taxi meter has started running.
Well, you immediately, because you have to respond to these things.
Yes,
you can't just ignore.
No, I remember in editing roles I've occupied in the past. This is a constant worry,
and it's a pain in the arse. It's a real pain in the arse. If you're not courageous and bolshy like we are, you know, I suspect there's lots of people who have gone away quietly, you know, which is awful when you think about it. That the reason they use this tactic is it must be effective in some cases. Anyway, they picked on the wrong guys with us, so we will sue them. We've got our legal team lined up. She mocked it last night, or her representatives mocked the effort, saying it was laughable. My word, you know, you still don't get it. You still don't get it, that there's nothing laughable about this instance. So we're coming after her. Even if we fail, I think it'll be worth...
It starts a conversation about the law, doesn't it? Which is really important. I think it might be worth just briefly recapping why this happened. Because the COVID inquiry so far has basically been about big personalities. But this was about... what happened in a system that was hugely underprepared. What's interesting is that we had been quite well prepared up until Brexit.
Yeah.
Because what happened was, if you look into it, is that Brexit sucked up so much oxygen and cost. Yes, the austerity cuts had made a difference, but the real problem, I mean, the pandemic had been categorised as top of the national risk register for many years. So there was no question, this idea that it came as a big shock. No, it didn't. There'd been MERS, SARS, swine flu, Ebola. You know, everyone knew that at some point there was a real risk of a pandemic and measures had been taken. But just as for instance, more than 200 million items of PPE, personal protection equipment, had expired in the 8 months before the virus arrived in the UK in January 2020. 45% of the 19,909 boxes that were kept in a warehouse in Merseyside had exceeded their use-by dates. Insanely, we were still exporting to China, where they make most PPE, as late as March 2020.
You're kidding.
Yeah. So inevitably, there was a crisis.
Yeah.
And was set up the VIP lane, so-called, which essentially was a profiteer's blank check, the way it was operated.
Certainly the way it's turned out.
Yeah, and, yeah. You know, the National Audit Office has said almost 500 suppliers with links to politicians or senior officials were referred to the VIP high priority channel. What could possibly go wrong? The gowns that Michel Moen's company provided... In June 2019, the government's own NERVTAC advisory group, that's the new and emerging respiratory virus threats advisory group, had specifically warned that gowns should be purchased. None of this was new. Mm. So we end up, what do we end up? We end up with gowns that can't be used, Moen and Barrowman pocketing 200 million, of which 122 million is wasted.
Yeah.
Going off and spending it.
Yeah.
And we also end up, let it never be forgotten, with at least 9,000 health workers dying from COVID.
Yeah, appalling.
You know, most of whom had inadequate PPE at one stage or another.
Yeah,
so the bigger context of this is life and death. It's not just it's truth and falsity. It's
you are absolutely right, and we I should be clear about it. What we're doing is a sideshow. It's important.
It's very important.
It'd be great if we can establish some. But it is a sideshow. And where Michel Moen is right is that there is clearly a bigger story to be told about the incompetence in government as well and the nefarious activities of this around this VIP channel. That's got to come out. You know,
we need to
understand that. I saw on Twitter a guy, UK, I must find out the name of the company, but he's a UK manufacturer of PPE, 1,600 employees in the UK. And they got 14 million quid's worth of contracts, right? Their business has been going for decades, right? They know the game inside out. Michel Moen and Doug Barrowman arrive and talking about, you know, almost like on the Dragon's Den, you know, when they're saying, I've got the best contacts in the Far East and all of this business. You know, I'm a manufacturing and branding expert. And what branding you need for PPE, I don't know. But anyway, they suddenly conjure up out of nowhere this consortium of people who rape the country of 65 million quid, as far as I'm concerned. You know, opportunistic profiteering. That's the only thing I can think to describe it. That's the real issue that needs to be absolutely pored over.
Grown-up governments are meant to prepare, and lots of them do. And to be fair, actually, the Blair and Brown governments did, for high-impact, what's it called, HILP, high-impact, low-probability events.
Right.
You know, a lot of things are not necessarily going to happen tomorrow, but they are probably going to happen eventually. And this, you know, the pandemic was top of the list. And yet, because, and I think this can't be said often enough, because of the short-termist, populist, slogan-led mentality of the Brexit era, this was just left to, you know, literally rot on the shelves of warehouses. And the country found itself in March, you know, the month when we went belatedly to lockdown, still exporting and finally activating what are called just-in-time contracts, which are the contracts you make as planning to get extra. But the problem, of course, is if you don't activate them in time, which the government didn't, the stock is gone.
Yeah.
So you can say, well, you owe, you know, whichever country it is, you owe us this, you owe us that. And they say, sorry, it's already gone to, you know, China, America, wherever.
Yeah.
That, I think, is going to be, or I hope it's going to be, a massive focus of the COVID inquiry as it moves away from personalities into processes.
Isn't that a problem, though? Because it has all been about who's screwed up the most and all of this business.
It's a challenge, the inquiry, to look at that. And then I think, to go back to Michel Moen herself, I do think you're right that there's a psychology at work here which really needs to be drained out of the political system, which is what we saw in Partygate, what we saw in the Chris Pincher sex scandal. We've seen it, you know, time and time again. It just goes on and on. Peter Bone's just been, you know,
Scott MP Benson.
It just keeps coming.
Endless layers.
Miriam Cates is the subject of some standards committee.
That'll be interesting.
We don't know what it is, but it's said to impugn the whole credibility of Parliament. So it must
be serious.
Sounds good,
yeah.
So there is this culture which we it's really important not to become desensitized to.
Yeah.
And I remember when you first told me about that cover, I thought, oh, this is going to be a really good cover. But I think since then I've become more and more sort of evangelical about it, because it really epitomizes something important, doesn't it?
I think it is illustrative of a very big macro problem. And, you know, maybe Michelle Moan will look back on this in a few years' time with a sense of grievance that she was made an example of. And maybe that's true, and maybe that's her tough luck, but she sort of brought it on herself. But she is the tip of the iceberg.
I don't think she's a scapegoat. They keep saying they're scapegoats. She's a case study, which is different.
Yes, that's right. That's
you know,
it, man.
I mean, it's a really important distinction to make. The other thing I realised is that she reminded me of some character in fiction, and I realised last night what it was, which is Catch-22, fantastic classic novel, Joseph Heller. There's a character in it called Milo Minderbinder, who's a profiteer, and he says, I'm quoting, anyone who would not steal from the country he loved would not steal from anyone. Right? That was his judge of other people's character.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel, you know, that was Joseph Heller's satire.
Yeah.
Right? Well, welcome to 2023, end thereof.
Yeah.
This is what this government and the people associated with it do and have, and this is the way they have behaved. And the one of the many reasons we desperately need a general election is this cannot go on.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Totally.
So I'm really proud to be, you know, a small cog in the big machine of the New European, which is taking this action, because win or lose, it's an important principle. It really is.
Thank you for saying that. And I'm delighted that you're on the journey with
100%.
Us. 100%. And my only plea of self-interest is to say to people, you know, you don't have to sit there feeling totally disenfranchised and powerless. You can help us, you know, you can help us, you can help organizations like the Byline Times, you can subscribe to the Guardian, you can help by supporting honest independent journalism that is kicking back against this malaise that we're suffering in this country.
Because the populists, the nativists, the right wingers, they want you to be cynical.
Yeah.
They want you to give up.
Yeah.
They want, you know, pessimism and cynicism is what they feed upon.
Yeah.
And you have to, I get it, you know, but you have to fight back against that.
We don't like pessimism and cynicism.
We're not having it, you know?
Welcome to the home of optimism
and hope. This is Chateau d'Optimism.
Chateau d'Hope. Well, listen, thank you for that.
On that bombshell of hope.
I'm sorry if I've come across as a bit ranty in that first half.
No, we love it.
It really did infuriate me the way she thought she could bully the New European.
Ranty, but festive. That's
good,
the way I look at it.
Festive ranting.
Festive ranting.
When we come back, we're going to speak to a woman we've both long admired, I think, in her...
Excellent person.
Zoe Gardner. Who is a campaigner on migration, which I think has been the issue of 2023. And
it really has.
I'm sure Zoe's going to shed a lot of light onto that.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to The Two Mats. And if you like the kind of conversations we have here, there are loads more to be had in print and online at The New European. And I have got a very special offer for all listeners of The Two Mats. We are giving away copies of Alistair Campbell's Diaries 2023, which is a book we're publishing this month. It's a fantastic diary full of everything that's happened, all the people he's met, and anybody who's a fan of Alistair Campbell's diaries over the years know how brilliantly he turns them out. He is very much a latter-day Samuel Pepys.
He really is.
He is. So you can get a free copy of Alistair Campbell's Diaries 2023 worth £20 when you subscribe to The New European from as little as £1 a week. Or if you like getting the newspaper delivered to your door every single week, you can have that for just another £1 a week. And that's a 75% saving on the price you'll pay at the newsagents. To get this great offer, go to www.thenewEuropean.co.uk/2mats.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Welcome back, everybody. Delighted to say we are joined by the illustrious Zoe Gardner, who is a policy migration expert and a journalist, and wrote a great piece in the New European this week about looking for concrete solutions rather than just obsessing on this rhetoric all the time. But let's obsess on the rhetoric for a little while, Zoe, because this year has been full of right-wing rhetoric about migration and immigration and asylum seeking and refugees, and we can unpick all of that. What's your view of how this government has conducted the issue over the last 12 months or so?
I cannot damn it strongly enough. I think it has been disgraceful. They've reached new lows almost every week of how they've spoken about this issue, let alone how they've actually handled it in terms of policy and in terms of how they've treated people. Just literally how they've spoken about people has been really absolutely disgraceful, and it has been shameful, and it has degraded our entire conversation, made it much more difficult to have any kind of honesty or serious conversations about what solutions are, because they've, you know, for a start, they've totally rebranded asylum seekers and refugees as illegal immigrants. It's not so much that it's not true, it's that it's a choice of how to frame people. There have always been refugees and asylum seekers coming to the UK. They have been called refugees and asylum seekers, despite the fact that they have always had to make irregular journeys in order to reach the UK, because that's what they are. They are people who are seeking sanctuary, seeking protection, and escaping from danger and from violence. You can make the choice to refer to people however you like, but if you speak about them as seekers of sanctuary, then you are framing them as people that we are able to help. And if you speak about them as illegal immigrants, you are framing them as a threat. What's been really shocking is how quickly I've seen all the mainstream news channels adopt this language, including the BBC, adopt the language of illegal immigrants, where they, a couple of years ago, were talking about asylum seekers and refugees. And that's just one example, but there's been, you know, a series of horrifying speeches, each one worse than the last. Obviously, you know, we thought it was Suella Braverman who was the leader in terms of terrible, hostile rhetoric and talking about a hurricane and talking about an invasion. But since she's been sacked, we saw Robert Jenrick, the immigration minister, ex-immigration minister now, talking about how migrants arriving in small boats like don't fit in with our culture and lots of horrible dog-whistly things like that. And then he wasn't sacked, he sacked himself, left the cabinet. And then we had the Prime Minister using the exact same type of language again in a speech just last week, saying that the UK and Europe are in danger of being overwhelmed.
Yeah, Sunak, as I understand it, went further and said that there was a risk of, I'm paraphrasing slightly, but hostile states sending people to Western nations in order to subvert them and cause them harm, which is, you know, horrifyingly close to the far right's great replacement theory. In you know, it's specific, but it, you know, this is Sunak, who was supposed to be the adult in the room and the technocrat, basically using hard right culture war language.
Exactly. Yeah. And And this is what I mean when I say that, you know, we've moved from Braverman saying it to Sunak saying it, and it's the exact same thing, the exact same extreme and very, very worrying rhetoric coming now directly out of the mouth of the Prime Minister. And that shift has happened just over a few months. He used to be the one who, while he was enacting the policies, he had somebody else saying the really horrible thing. But in this is how it's escalating. It's getting much faster, the escalation in terms of like how far our politicians are willing to go, how much they are willing to demonize migration and present it as an existential threat, a civilizational threat, which is a complete lie. Of course, we must talk about that in terms of, you know, just totally debunking the idea that there are some sort of hordes at the gates. It's complete nonsense. But it's been a massive and very, very quick and very scary escalation in terms of the rhetoric that we're seeing, and it should be worrying us all, I think.
Zoe, what's the chicken and the egg in this scenario? Is it the media or is it the politicians? Who's because I know the rhetoric in the media has been going for decades now, and it's tied into an all sorts of issues, but it seems to have reached a crescendo this year. And I wonder, do you feel that the politicians are just following the Daily Mail's lead? You know, is it this kind of motivation?
I would have said back in the past that maybe it was politicians following the Daily Mail's lead. I actually don't think it is anymore. I think politicians are leading this now. I think that, right, you know, if you look even a year ago, year and a half ago, and you go into the pandemic, people's views on migration were really positive. The conversation in the papers about migration was, well, it was more subdued for a start. There has been an ongoing sort of blood-curdling cries from the usual suspects, the Mail, the Sun, about the small boats. But honestly, I have seen, again, these like key point speeches from Braverman and then now from others. She will say an invasion, and then you see in the papers and on social media and in the media in general, the word invasion. She will say a hurricane, and then you see a hurricane. Her bill, a piece of legislation that she passed, about 8 months ago now, she called it the illegal migration bill. And that was a piece of legislation focused entirely on refugees. She changed that language. And it was very clearly from that moment that I saw the definitive shift happened, the likes of the BBC and so on, the mainstream press picking up that language about illegal migrants rather than asylum seekers. So I think this has been led from the top, really, which, right, yeah, and which don't get scary. Me wrong, the media is along for the ride, but...
I mean, I suppose, though, the interesting thing is we're looking forward to 2024, potential change of government. And we've, on the podcast, we've talked often of a sort of cross-spectrum reset on the whole issue of border control, migration, and a more positive way of looking at it that's both compassionate, competent and speedy. And I'm wondering, you pointed out in your piece for the New European that Labour have been, they've limited themselves to quite sort of tough rhetoric and tough measures. But in a broader sense, what is the kind of suite of measures that might lead to a better system? Because it seems to me that what we've got here is just performative politics. You know, the only thing it's really doing is injecting toxins into the political bloodstream and keeping 122,000 asylum seekers unprocessed. The whole thing needs to be rethought, and a new form of political discourse needs to envelop it. And I just wondered what your kind of top few, you know, your shopping list of things would be.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Labour, I think it seems very likely at this stage that Labour will form the next government, and what they do next will have a massive impact in terms of whether the UK continues in the vein that we're seeing internationally of a slide further towards the far right or not. So I think it's absolutely vital that they introduce major changes basically in how we handle this, because I think the evidence shows us that the consensus of even sort of centre left and centre right and sort of liberal democratic politics around this issue for so long has been to accept a certain level of demonization, a certain level of hostility, but also you know, face up to the reality that migration is desperately needed. Irregular migration is very, very difficult issue to stop. And so sort of still have the numbers coming in and sort of use that to play against each other and have a bit of hostility and the numbers still come in. I think there's been a sort of wise up to that. People are not accepting that anymore. And that's why I think the rhetoric has got so much more extreme, because that's what people are... That's what the demand is. People are saying, seeing that politicians who have said they're going to be this tough are not stopping migration. And so we want now politicians to be that tough, way, way, way more so, and say things that are truly scary and worrying for all our rights. And that's what Keir Starmer will have to confront, is that if he tries to go back to the status quo as before the Tories, as before Brexit, he will not solve the issue. It would be better than what we have now, don't get me wrong. It's got a lot worse in the last 5 years, 10 years, the situation for refugees and asylum seekers. But if he tries to just go back to how it was before, when there were still, you know, refugees in Calais trying to cross, it was in lorries back then more so than in boats. But really, honestly, the difference that isn't so important. That will still continue to be seen as a failure. And if that sort of sensible so-called politics is then seen to have failed, then that opens up the gates. So like, all right, right, well, then, you know, we tried being more sensible. We tried being more kind. We need to now go to the extreme right. That's what I worry about. So, sorry. With that said, in terms of what they should do, they should certainly, obviously, and they have said they will do this, is focus on processing people's claims extremely much more quickly than has been done, even especially in the last couple of years, where the system has basically ground to a stop. But also in the past several years, it's been completely standard. Even for the past decade, it's been quite standard for people to spend, in many cases, several years in the asylum system. That should just simply never be happening. It's not.
And that means spending some money, doesn't it? I mean, Liam Byrne.
It means spending some money, but
Rwanda debate.
It can be done in a much quicker and more efficient way. So yes, it does. An asylum system will cost money. A decent asylum system costs money, just as sort of any other functioning part of the state does cost money. I think it would cost significantly less if we didn't spend, you know, £300 million on harebrained schemes with Rwanda. There are other areas of waste in the system, certainly not processing people's claims and housing them in hotels for the long term. That's also very expensive. So yes, there would be a cost, but I don't believe, you know, I think we'd actually be redistributing money into a more efficient system and ultimately saving a lot of money. Because another thing is that we should be allowing people to work much quicker. Now, I think it obviously makes sense in the current conversation to talk about asylum seekers having the right to work while they're waiting for their claim to be processed. That makes sense now because they're waiting for several years and being forced into economic inactivity.
Yeah.
But actually, if you were resolving people's claims within a few months, that wouldn't be necessary. And then once, you know, a couple of months in the system, and then you come out of it with a status and the protection that you need and the possibility to get on with your life and then start working, that's a much better system actually than one in which people spend so long in the system that actually they should be allowed to work while still in it. And then, yeah, we need to look to Europe, and we need to look to what kind of a deal we're going to get with Europe, and we need to... This will be difficult, don't get me wrong, but it's what has to be done, is to lead Europe in a direction of responsibility sharing rather than shirking, rather than pushing.
Does that mean rejoining the Dublin Agreement, Zoe?
I don't think it has to be. Honestly, I think the Dublin Agreement is just highly dysfunctional. And again, it's going back to where we were before, which didn't work very well. Now, things that were good about the Dublin Agreement, it enabled people with family members in the UK who found themselves in Europe to apply to come here directly and safely. That should definitely be a feature of any approach we have. But the other side of the Dublin Agreement was that people who could not demonstrate a family link to the UK could be returned to, say, Italy, Greece, wherever they had first entered the European Union. And that system was firstly very inefficient and clunky, because it was required each individual to be passed the parcel between detention centres in different countries, which was just inadequate. But also it perpetuates the same problem, which is that it denies people agency. It denies the reality that just because we're geographically on the westernmost edge of Europe, it just doesn't diminish our responsibility to help people and our connections to the rest of the world. And it denies the reality that the reason why people pass through Italy, France, in order to get to the UK is because they don't have another way to get here. It's not because that was their chosen method and then therefore there's any sense in saying, well, you should stay there. And so, you know, I think what the deal with Europe needs to look like is a way of facilitating travel through Europe safely into our asylum system, into the other asylum systems of Western Europe as well, while we're at it. But to enable people, you know, and it's a few tens of thousands of people every year, enable them to come to the UK as safely as you or I would travel between France and the UK and enter a system that is run fast and well. And I want to emphasize just really, really clearly here, because when I say that, people say, oh, you're talking about letting everybody in. Yeah, I'm talking about letting the exact same people who come in now in as well, just safely. That is the difference, because all the lies about stopping the boats don't actually happen, right? People still come in, just very dangerously and in chaos. I'm talking about the same system, just formalize it, regularize it, so we know who people are. We're bringing them through a system that works and that functions and that's credible, and nobody's dying, and no criminal gangs are getting rich off of it. That's the difference. It's not a difference between letting people in or not letting people in. There's no not letting people in, and we need to kill that's not a thing. People will need protection. Some of them, a very small proportion, will seek it in the UK. I'm talking about formalising that system.
That was the tweet, I think, that I thought, well, we've got to get Zoe on, because you tweeted, when politicians talk about they've explored every possible avenue, you know, the one avenue they haven't explored is just creating a safe route in where people can be processed quickly, which is the bleeding obvious route for any solution to this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's, you know, the politicians saying that we'll do whatever it takes, and that gives the lie to what they're trying to do. Because what drives me up the wall more than anything else is the idea that there's some kind of humanitarian motivation for sending desperate refugees to Rwanda. There is not, right? This is not about saving lives. If you want to save lives, you have your option. It's very evident. You give people safe means to travel. Yeah. If you want to prevent...
There's no such thing as a compassionate deterrent, is there?
Of course not.
I mean, that's an oxymoron.
It would be a contradiction in terms. And the deterrence has been proven not to work. And I mentioned this in my New Europeans article as well, but I think it's really important.
Yes.
You know, people say, oh, if we send people to Rwanda, if we make it harder to cross, you know, tens of thousands of people have drowned crossing the Mediterranean. It's not a deterrent. People still come. And then there's the extreme end of things, where you literally have Saudi Arabia that is shooting people trying to cross the border. Hundreds of migrants being shot for attempting to cross the border. So a much more active way of killing people for trying to cross the border than ours, which is just to let them drown passively. That is not stopping migration, because people need solutions. They need to migrate. They need to cross that border. And so if shooting them in the face doesn't deter people, then there is literally nothing that the UK can do that will deter people. And I don't want that to sound scary, because these are not hordes of people. These are a manageable number of people who can be a great asset to our country.
I think it's so important to emphasize this point about the narrative, the demonization you spoke about at the very beginning. And we did a feature last year about the 37 people who drowned in the channel. And we went and looked at every single one of their stories and the human story behind it and the journey they'd taken. And these were human beings with real, relatable stories that I defy anybody, whatever your political persuasion, to read their stories and to say, no, these are demons of some sort. You know, that anything that correlates to the language that Suella Braverman comes out with, they're not. And we've got to find a way of changing that narrative as well. You know, if you ask people, I think, about what does illegal migration look like? They think of that Farage poster, you know, the
Breaking point.
That's what they think of. That's the image. And people like you, ourselves, whatever the organisations on the good side of this argument are, we need to find a way of presenting simple narratives that change people's minds, you know, so that they've got a fairer picture of migration.
That's what's interesting about this as well, like how much we're pushing this story, or we're having pushed down our throats rather, this story of, you know, 30,000 people crossing on a boat, because there's been a major shift in how we see other migrants. And we understand that you know, there's been very high net immigration figures for migrants coming for all sorts of different reasons to study and to work. They are understood as being people who care for our relatives in care homes. They are understood as being doctors and nurses, or they're understood as being students who we have, again, positive associations with. They come, they enrich our intellectual life, our cultural life. They bring in a significant amount of money to the economy. You know, all of these positive associations we have. Those narratives don't suit this government at all. They are focusing in on this really, really proportionately tiny number of people who they can still demonize because we haven't successfully told an effective human story about the wonderful things that they can bring us. And again, it's just presented as, oh, well, you want to let these people in. Well, yeah, that would be good, actually. These are great people, or they're just ordinary people who can do as much as any of us can, you know, contribute to our communities and our economy and our society in so many ways. They're not scary, and they need to be humanized, but they're denied that humanity so brutally by our current conversation.
I can't get my head around still to this day when you come out of the arrivals area in Stansted Airport, or any airport, there's a kiosk, manned kiosk, with signs saying, if you've come, are you a Ukrainian refugee, come here, and here's the government assistance and all of this. So if you're a victim of a war perpetrated by Vladimir Putin in Ukraine, you get that treatment in the UK. If you're a victim of a war perpetrated by Vladimir Putin and Bashar Assad in Syria, you get a poster from Nigel Farage telling you to F off. I can't understand what the difference is.
Well, yeah, again, it is quite horrifying, the difference in narrative and the difference in how we talk about it. And it's very, very rooted in Islamophobia and racism, definitely, right. Because it just simply wouldn't have been justified. It was amazing. We've helped, 240,000 Ukrainian refugees in the UK. That's an amazing thing that we've done. And it's a really, really big number of people. We can't help 30,000 people who've crossed on a boat, though. That's an overwhelming problem. Yeah. That's an invasion. That's something that's costing us billions. You know, that's how that's framed. And it's because those people are so much... The story, we haven't told the story. We don't tell the story of the fact that the war is still going on in Syria. Putin's still dropping his bombs in Syria. We don't tell the story about Sudan. You know, Afghanistan is barely in the papers anymore, even though the number one nationality of people crossing on those boats are Afghans. Surely we should be able to understand that these are people. But it's always, again, why here? They could have been somewhere else. But nobody questions... You know, those Ukrainians, they could have been somewhere else. But we're proud to let them come here.
Zoe, thank you for shedding light
and
some heat, which is always good to accompany a bit of light on this topic. And we hope you'll come back again.
Please do.
And we didn't talk about the European Union Pact, which we can talk about when we really understand that inside out. But thank you so much. Have a wonderful Christmas.
Have a great Christmas.
Come back soon.
See you in 2024.
And see you in 2024.
Yeah,
thank you.
Thanks, Zoe. New year. Hopefully better politics than this year.
So thank you very much, folks. I hope you enjoyed that conversation. Please get your questions in and any feedback to the 2MATTS, that's the number 2, M-A-T-T-S, at tnepublishing.com. That's 2MATTS at tnepublishing.com. Or if you listen on Spotify, you can message us there. There's a little box underneath where you're listening. You can just tap in your questions or feedback there. And that's exactly what Gideon Monsoon did, who says, "Hi, thoughts on what would happen if a significant number of voters vote for a third candidate rather than Trump or Biden? Have you got any? Is there any potential for that?"
Yes, I think there is with Robert Kennedy Jr. And I think that's a real problem. It's a real variable in this election. It's a good question.
It's going to be absolutely fascinating, this election, isn't it?
Oh, it's amazing.
I mean, I genuinely can't think of a more fascinating setup for.
And now there's the prospect since the Colorado Supreme Court vote on whether he'll be on the ballot at all.
So we've got all that to look forward to in 2024, folks. And we will be back with a new episode in the new year. We've got something very special planned, actually. We've got a special Heroes, Villains and Departed episode. Just before the new year. In our new year special. Don't forget our Christmas deal where you can subscribe to The New European. You'll get a free copy of Alistair Campbell's Diaries 2023. But more importantly, you will be getting a full year's worth of fantastic journalism, and you'll be part of the fight back against corrosive nationalism and the kind of bigotry we've seen 2023 festooned with. So don't stand for it. Join the team here at The New European. Just go to theneweuropean.co.uk/2Matts. That's the number 2, M-A-T-T-S. There's a link in the show notes and you can join for just £1 a week. Thank you as ever, and thank you for a full year's worth of brilliance from our team here at Rethink Audio, led today by the third Matt Hill. Until next week.
It's Happy Christmas from me.
And it's Happy Christmas from him.
Happy Christmas.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.